Member-supported Jazz 90.1 proudly welcomes you to America's longest-running computer show, Soundbites. Call the show now at 966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll-free 800-790-0415 or soundbites.org. Now, alongside Steve Ray and Dave Enright, here's Nick Francesco on Member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Good afternoon, Mr. and Mrs. America, and all the chips in the PC. It is Saturday, the 1st of March, Anno Domini 2013, and you lucky people. You're listening to Soundbites. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Steve Ray.
And I'm Michael Oden.
And at 4 minutes after the hour, we're going to be bringing you news, views, things to choose, nothing to lose. Kick off your shoes. Don't get the blues. It's time for the news. Researchers said they have identified a flaw in Apple's iOS. This is not a repeat of earlier in the week, by the way.
Yeah, they just fixed one flaw and here's another one.
Yeah. Researchers said they have identified a flaw in Apple's iOS that makes it possible for attackers to surreptitiously log every touch a user makes, including characters typed into the keyboard, touch ID presses, and adjustments to the volume control. It could be because that's so important. The vulnerability affects even non-jailbroken iPhones and iPads running iOS version 7.0.4, 7.0.5, 7.0.6. as well as those running on 6.1 point anything. Researchers from the security firm FireEye wrote in a blog post published Monday night. They said attackers could carry out the covert monitoring using an app that bypasses Apple's stringent app review process. The app uses multitasking capabilities built into iOS to capture user inputs. iOS apps can surreptitiously record all user touch press events in the background and send them to a remote server. Attackers can use such information to reconstruct every character the victim inputs. Shortly before the information went live, FireEye published a separate brief that was quickly removed, according to the RSS reader cache that preserved the earlier post. Part of it said FireEye successfully delivered a proof-of-concept monitoring app through the App Store that records user activity and sends it to a remote server. We've been collaborating with Apple on this issue. Based on a few details provided in the blog posts, the proof of concept app appears to rely on resources iOS provides for applications running in the background, as music apps frequently do. As they run behind the scenes, they appear to have visibility into all presses made to the keyboard and all other iPhone or iPad buttons. Until Apple releases a patch for the vulnerability, the only way to prevent attacks is to open the iOS Task Manager and stop questionable apps from running in the background, assuming you know which ones are questionable. Users can open the Task Manager by pressing the home button twice. The disclosure comes 3 days after Apple patched an extremely critical iOS vulnerability that gave attackers an easy way to bypass encryption many browsers and other types of apps use to prevent eavesdropping of passwords and other sensitive data. So, our poll of the week at soundbites.org, that's bites with a Y, Francis would like us to remind you, is yet another unfixed vulnerability in iOS. Your choices are, I'm completely devastated, I'm a bit surprised, I'm not surprised at all, and I owe who now? So far, we have 26 votes, and I owe who now is just edging out, I'm not surprised at all. Now, you can give us a vote at soundbites.org, and I know when you're done with that, you will have a lot more to say about this issue. So check the forums out. If you go down the right-hand column to Fascinating Stuff, the top link is for the forums, and this particular thing is on 1 March 14, yet another unfixed vulnerability in iOS. And give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free 1-800-790-0415.
Yeah, it's always frustrating when you fix a bug and then someone finds a new bug.
Immediately,
yeah. Although the last bug was a programming failure. One, because they used a go-to command. And two, because they pasted it in twice.
Right.
Yeah.
And that was by Apple's own programmers. That was not
right.
Somebody found that exploit in the operating system itself. It's not like somebody. This one is separate. This is an app that you have to download.
There have been a few of those apps that sneak into the App Store and do things they don't say they do. And so Apple's quick to point out that if you follow the rules, then there's no problem. But the bad guys don't follow the rules. And there have been several cases where apps have snuck in, get approved by doing something, and then there's hidden code that makes them do something else.
Right.
Part of the problem is because Apple wants to vet every app that comes in, they have to physically look at them. And so apparently what we're hearing is that they don't have enough people to look at a million apps a day or whatever the ridiculous number it is.
Yeah.
So they have automated programs that just that check for not following the programming rules. But there's no way to automate someone who sneaks code in that isn't documented or doesn't do something else.
Right,
so they
right.
have to physically look at those programs. And one of them a few months ago that got found, the researcher was able to remotely activate a feature that wasn't documented. And that was how he got it submitted, and then he was able to take data from the phone. So it's good that researchers are doing this, and Apple will try to fix these holes that get found. But the other thing is pay attention when you're buying an app, you know, what the rating is. In fact, there have been several cases where a malicious app goes on the store to do something stupid like a calculator or the infamous fart apps.
Right.
And then they sit there for a few months gaining ratings. And the better rated an app is, the higher up the list it gets, which means more people see it. Then a few months later, the developer will push an update that adds whatever the malicious function is.
Right.
And since the app has high ratings and has a lot of people using it, that's how they can capture it.
And does the update come also through the App Store, and is it vetted in the same way?
It is vetted, but apparently not vetted as deeply as a brand new app.
Yeah, see? And that makes a certain amount of sense, because again, when you're getting a million new ones a day,
yeah.
And how many billions are in there now, millions are in there now, updating them becomes a constant
tricky
stream.
And we always hear from developers who submitted an app and it can take weeks to get approved because there's so many apps ahead of you in the list.
Right.
Where on the other side, in the Android store, any Android developer can push any app they want, and Google routinely removes hundreds of bad apps that they find after the fact. But generally that they wait until someone reports the problem, because they don't look at the apps as they're being uploaded.
Well, they've scrubbed them. I mean, they scan them with antivirus stuff. But again, if it's a new exploit, there's no signature against it.
One of my favorite ones a couple of years ago was an app that was named Find and Call. And the description was, is it found your friends and let you call them.
Don't we call that using our finger on the phone book?
Well, apparently it found your friends and called them without asking you first.
Nice.
And so everyone was all up in arms, and Apple took it off the store. And my joke at the time was, well, that's what the app said it was going to do. Why are you surprised?
Exactly.
So as long as you disclose that you're a jerk when you put your app up there, you're following the rules.
And what was it telling them?
Sending ads.
Oh, of course it did.
Yeah.
Oh, speaking of which, we should also mention, just a reminder, you can give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free 1-800-790-0415. We should remind everyone that there is an actual spate of scams going on with Microsoft, not from Microsoft, but purporting to be from Microsoft. And what happens, you will get a phone call that says, we're from Microsoft and there's a problem with your machine. Download this, pay us $100, blah, 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 whatever it is. That's all completely bogus. They're just trying to get into your machine to steal stuff.
They also
let me just point out, and this is important to know, Microsoft will never, ever, ever call you. They didn't become a multi-gazillion dollar company by calling their customers. So if you get a call from Microsoft, it ain't Microsoft.
And that pretty much goes for every company. Apple has been targeted by these scams, too. Companies aren't going to call you if there's a problem. The FBI is not going to warn you that they're going to come arrest you and tell you to go to Walmart and buy a money pack to pay your fine. But
if the FBI wants your money, they will have your money.
Yeah. There was a couple of them targeting Apple users in the last couple of weeks, where you get a message saying that we've received notification that you, you're going to terminate your iCloud account. Click here to verify. Well, for one, you can't terminate your iCloud account. You just stop using it.
Right.
But two, you click there, and then you type in your iCloud credentials because you want to keep your account going, and now you've given the bad guys your credentials because it's a fake message. Apple doesn't send you messages like that. They tell you, you know, if there's a change to your account, they tell you to go log in yourself.
Right.
Yeah.
It's... we're seeing a lot of these things, and I'm sure we'll start seeing them for iOS, and we'll start seeing them for Android. And
well, anywhere there's a credit card, so they're after your Apple ID that you buy things with on the store, and your Google Play account that you buy things with on the store.
Right.
And once they have your account credentials, they have your money.
As more and more phones come out with NFC, near field communication, you've seen credit cards that you can just tap on a terminal, and you don't have to scan it anymore. You just tap it. That's called a near-field communication device, and you can get those in your phone, too. So you can just tap with your phone and buy something through your Google Play account.
There have been several cases where if people will have several, especially if they're real big in Europe, and people will have several different cards with different NFC chips in them.
Right.
And it was a big case at a London grocery store where a woman was rummaging in her purse to pull a card out, and the computer had already debited her account from another card still in her purse.
Oh, interesting.
Near field is supposed to be a centimeter or two.
Right.
But apparently it works a lot farther than that.
It does. And what's nice about having it in your phone is that you can turn it on or off as you choose. So I have it on my phone, but I have turned it off. If I want to pay for something with my phone, all I have to do is go hit the little app on the screen. Up it comes, boom, make the sale, turn it back off again.
Yeah, that's actually very big in Japan from what
Japan,
I've read,
huge.
Too. Vending, well, RIT
a lot
has
of vending
them now.
Machines, yeah.
You know, the vending machine has a spot for your phone to debit your account from.
Yep. And more people are doing it because it is so convenient. People care more. Well, people pay more attention to their phone than they do to their wallets. If you lose your wallet, for many people, it could be hours before you notice it. But
yeah,
most of these people have their phone in their hand all the time.
So that's why we have Google Wallet and Apple Passbook.
That's exactly
right. In your phone is now your electronic wallet.
That's exactly right, which means that you don't need to carry as much stuff in your wallet. You can get the grocery store shopper cards in your phone as well.
Yeah,
and
Wegmans now has that scanning thingy up. Channel 8 posted a photo from one last night at the East App Store. They had the scanning thing where they can scan your phone now.
Yep.
Yeah, you don't have to take a physical coupon. You bring a coupon up on your phone, and they can scan that.
Yeah, it's amazing stuff that we're able to do now. But it also means we have to think, well, differently about things like security. And it behooves all of us to be aware of that and to pay attention to that.
And that's one reason Apple started putting the fingerprint readers on the iPhone 5S is that electronic wallet and your electronic credit cards are only as safe as your password. So by adding fingerprints as a second a tier, or in Apple's case, the first tier, that biometric data helps secure your electronic information.
Right. And Smiley, who has joined us in the Google Hangout, says the telephone, for the scammers who are calling and saying they're from Microsoft, the telephone number starts with 124, which is not a United States area code. They're very hard to understand when they speak. He said they called him three times the same day. And finally quit after his wife hung up on them the third time.
Although that can often be said about real tech support people when you call in. And actually, that's another problem. If you Google Microsoft support or Apple support, you're going to find ads above the actual search, especially on Bing, which is more common as the default Windows search engine. And we've had a lot of people who call one of these ad companies thinking they're calling Microsoft or thinking they're calling Apple.
That people advertising that they're Microsoft on Bing Bing wouldn't let them do that because they're owned by Microsoft.
Bing gets paid.
Well, it says Microsoft tech support. It doesn't say they are Microsoft.
I know, but you would think that Microsoft Windows owning a browser.
And a lot of these places will give
owning a search engine would say, no, we're not going to let you do that because you're fraud because you're pretending to be
at least make the ad more visible. It's got a yellow background, but it's a very pale yellow.
Very, on both on both Google and on Bing.
But at least on Google, it puts it over on the side, not on, on the left where you're thinking about your major results. But a lot of those tech support companies will sell you a subscription. So it's $300 to answer your phone call.
Right.
But that's actually like a 6-month subscription for any amount of phone call. So they technically aren't doing anything illegal. They are selling you a subscription for service.
Right. But if you call a second time, they'll charge you again if you don't say, but wait.
Yep.
Right. All right. Listen, we're going to take a quick break. But we'll be back in just a couple of minutes with Steve Ray, Michael Oden, me, Nick Francesco, and you. Yes, Dave Enright is one step ahead of the law somewhere in the Midwest. Hopefully we'll see him next week. But in the meantime, it's 20 minutes after the hour, and for some odd reason, you continue to listen to the longest-running computer show in the known universe. It's Soundbites on member-supported Jazz 90.1. Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Steve Ray.
And I'm Michael Oden.
And at 23 minutes after the hour, we are Soundbites. And you can give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll-free 1-800-790-0415, just like Linda did from Greece, New York. Welcome, Linda. How are you?
I'm fine. Long time no here, guys.
I know. How you been?
Oh, okay. I got a couple of questions. I've got an iPad Air, but, you know, you always say change the passwords. I can never remember. What's the best password manager that's easy to use for an iPad?
Well, there's one built in called Keychain, and that's especially useful if you're also have a Macintosh because it can sync your passwords between your iPad and your Mac. On the iPad and cross-platform, so iPad, Android, Mac, and Windows, there's one called 1Password, and there's another one called LastPass.
Which one would you suggest?
And another one called KeePass. The three of them together are all very good. I think LastPass is free for both ends. I think 1Password you pay for the iPad end, but it's free for the Mac end. It's or Windows end. It's so you can go to each of their websites and try them out. They both will offer to create long, complicated passwords that you have no hope of remembering, which is the way you want a website password to be. So you just have to remember your 1Password.
Okay.
One thing you will have to remember with KeePass is its password.
So it doesn't use your computer password, it makes its own password.
Yeah.
Okay. I know 1Password will on your Mac will use your Mac password as its master password.
As I believe will LastPass.
Yeah.
So you might be better off with LastPass than with KeePass.
Another thing. Unfortunately, my Windows 7 laptop died. So I've now got Windows 8. But I put the classic shell on it. Now, with the classic shell on it, can I use it like Windows 7?
Basically,
That's the point of classic shell. It gives you back that regular desktop that everybody loves so much and hates that Windows 8 took away.
Okay. What would you suggest is a good tutorial to teach me? Well, do I need a tutorial to teach me Windows 8 if I've got Classic Shell?
Classic Shell theoretically works almost exactly like Windows 7.
Okay.
So you really shouldn't need any tutorial. Well, in 99.9% of it will be completely familiar to you.
Okay.
So there may be one or two very small things that you run across that are slightly different, but 99.9% of it will be the same.
Okay, and now, Microsoft if I want to hook up a wireless printer with this, because I've got a new Dell laptop, how do I do that?
You have to follow the directions in the printer manual to add the printer to your network, And then part of that is installing drivers on the computer, so then the computer sees it, the printer on your network.
Okay.
Yeah, unfortunately, we don't memorize how to do any of the 3,000 different printers that are out there. So you will have to follow.
Okay, but if I go into printer on my Dell laptop and I turn my printer on, won't it find it?
No, because you have to set your printer up to the network first.
My printer is set up to the network already.
Okay, then it should find it. Yeah.
Yeah, because it was set up to my Windows 7 laptop. I've always printed things from that.
Oh, so it's not a new printer, too?
No.
Oh,
no,
then
it's
yeah,
an old printer, and it's set up to Windows 7. But, you know, so I should be able to automatically find it on my Windows 8.
Yep.
You may need to download a driver from the printer manufacturer. But theoretically, Windows will do that for you.
What might happen is one of two things will happen. Either it'll find it and say, okay, you're ready to go, or it'll find it and say you have to download a driver. Is that okay? And you say yes, and then you're ready to go.
Okay. So I miss Dave. Where is he?
This is one step ahead of the law, somewhere in the Midwest. Theoretically, he'll be back next week.
I love your answer. Okay, thanks a lot, guys.
Yep.
Thank you.
And Microsoft does have some video tutorials on their website for getting started with your new Windows 8 laptop or tablet.
Well, except there for the Windows 8 startup, she's got Classic Shell, so that won't work.
Right. So if you want to learn Windows 8,
right,
which is what Microsoft would like you to do.
Well, maybe not anymore.
What's going to happen is Windows 9 going to take that away again? Or they rip the Band-Aid off and force you to learn that touch interface? And just assume that all the PC manufacturers will put touchscreens on all their computers.
Well, and that's the problem. It's an excellent interface if you take the time to learn it and you have a touchscreen.
Yep.
If you don't have a touchscreen, it's really a clumsy, clumsy interface.
Yep.
And I know there are people who absolutely love it. God bless each and every one of you.
I never understood why they didn't make two versions of Windows 8, one for touchscreen and one for the average regular PC or laptop.
Well, they did that with Windows XP, and it never really worked.
Right. Well, it was, you know.
Yeah.
But it's expensive. You maintain two code bases. You maintain two sets of programmers. You maintain what if you write apps for the Windows 8 interface and they're not going to run on the desktop interface. So how do you handle all that?
The same way companies do apps for both iPhone and Android.
No, yeah. I get that, but that just is one more burden
and
for the programmers.
Twice the cost.
And twice the cost. Often. So
Apple has addressed that a little bit with their Magic Mouse that has a touch interface on the mouse and the Magic Trackpad that has the multi-touch interface that you can do your multi-touch gestures with on an inexpensive trackpad on your computer that doesn't have touch on the computer. We anticipate and expect Apple will start doing touch computers eventually, but they add dramatically to the price. Well, look at a Chromebook. A regular Chromebook is $250. The Chromebook with the touch interface is $1,250.
Yeah. Well, we all think that that's an inflated price because they really wanted that to be a reference model,
yeah,
not something that the average user would buy.
Yep. It's like the Google Glasses for $1,500.
Again, yeah, a reference model. There's a local company here in town, Vuzix, V-U-S-I-X, who makes a number of different types of glasses, one of which is comparable to Google Glass, and it's only $1,000. So certainly there's room for that price to come down, the M100 there.
Yeah. We used to sell, I forget the name of the company, there was a company that made, before they were smart internet-connected glasses, it was basically computer glasses that was a monitor. And so it was, a lot of people used it for private computing. You put the glasses on and no one can see your screen. And you could also use it for video, watching video from your tablets and, right, and video players.
One of the problems with any Google Glass or the M100 from Vuzix or any of these is, I got to play with a Google Glass earlier this week and, it's very visible, very easy to actually see. The problem is the real estate is almost non-existent. It's just tiny. It's three or four lines of text, and that's all. And I've seen some interfaces for some proposed apps where people try to put, way too much stuff.
Yep.
in there, and you really want one piece of information, two at the most.
A lot of the science fiction books that I've been reading lately have what they're calling an e-butler or virtual vision, and it's an actual digital implant, which everyone sees as the next logical progression of right. glasses, and you see this information pop up in your virtual vision. So with Google Glasses, you have to look up and to the left to see the screen.
Or right.
Or right, whichever side you wear it on. But with virtual vision, if it just floats in front of you...
Right, it's a heads-up yeah. display. It's yeah. a HUD, and that's yep. that's a very different thing.
And of course, there's been scenes where the husband is watching the game instead of paying attention to the wife, and she yells at him and can break into his virtual vision and superimpose herself in front of the game. You'll pay attention to me now. Right. But it's an interesting concept, you know, extrapolating the smartphone in our hand that has, you know, the world's information built into it. To actually putting that in your head so you can call it up anytime you want.
Right. And that's, of course, what we're all looking for. We all want to pretend to be smarter than we are, and if we can just take a quarter of a second and call up the information, yep. we'll look like we're... You know, that's yeah. the end of Jeopardy right yeah. there. Yeah. That's... You're done.
You have to do it in the Faraday cage. John C. Dvorak had an interesting thing about you can't remember anybody's name or your spouse or children. So what he does when he always sees someone again, oh, how you doing? Where are you at now? And do you have a new business card? And then the person hands you their business card. Hey, there's their name on it. And then yep. that will probably spark your memory.
Yep. I used to remember dozens of phone numbers. And now I can't even remember my daughter's phone number.
Yeah, it's speed dial 6.
I can't even remember the phone number for my cell phone. Whenever somebody asks yep. me for my phone number for my cell phone, I have to go into my settings.
Let me call you, and then it will yeah. be in your call ID.
I have to go into my settings, find it.
Yep. So now the big thing is what order in your speed dial number are they between your boss right. and your wife and your children?
Right. My wife is speed dial one. Well,
one is always voicemail. So.
Well, but on a cell phone, on the smartphones, you don't even do speed dial.
Yeah.
You've just got to tap an icon.
Yep.
So do they get first page real estate,
yep.
or do you have to scroll left or right to get to them, and their second page real estate is the real issue right there.
Yep.
I've got them all in a little folder, so I just open the folder, and there they are, and everybody's equal.
What's your cell phone number? Hang on here.
Yeah.
Yep.
I remember my Google Voice number because of the acronym, but I don't remember my cell phone number.
Yeah.
I always go, hold on, let me look.
Yep. No, but my number, horrible. Is it your number?
And everybody always laughs when you do that, but it's a laugh of, oh, I'm right there with you because I don't remember mine either.
Yep.
All right, we've got time for a little bit of news. Speaking of cell phone, this is one of my favorites. On January 29th, Google announced that it had agreed to sell Motorola, its phone manufacturing business, to Chinese electronic giant Lenovo. Thus concluded the company's brief, unprofitable foray into smartphone hardware. Except that it didn't really end there. It turns out that Google was holding on to one organization within Motorola, the Advanced Technology and Projects, or ATAP Group, headed by Regina Dugan, the former director of the U.S. Defense Department's fabled Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, or DARPA. Yes, the woman who ran DARPA went to Motorola and now works for Google. ATAP aims to bring the same approach to mobile gadget innovation that DARPA used to kickstart the internet, satellite navigation, stealth fighters, and other technologies that started small and eventually mattered a lot. Among the ATAP initiatives that have been announced, one in particular is quintessentially googly. It's Project ARA, A-R-A, which aims to reinvent the smartphone by breaking it down into modules that can be assembled and customized in a limitless number of configurations. The company first disclosed that the project existed on October 29th of last year when it released some intriguing photos, but little in the way of concrete details. Wednesday, it lifted the veil further as it prepares for an ARA Developer Conference it's holding in Silicon Valley's Computer History Museum on April 15th and 16th. A year or so from now, it hopes to have a product on the market. Right now, if you buy a smartphone, the odds are that you'll get something that one of a handful of large companies designed to appeal to tens of millions of people. And as capable as modern phones are, that dynamic leads to a certain sameness. By allowing for features to be implemented as user-installable modules, Project Ara's creators hope to make smartphones a lot more interesting. It's a big, improbable dream, even based on what little information Google has disclosed to date. Pundits have been busy pointing out the pitfalls, but if Ara works as advertised, and large numbers of phone buyers buy into the proposition, they could get something that contrasts sharply with the traditional breed of off-the-shelf phones released on a yearly schedule. For instance, when Samsung announced the Galaxy S5 this week, its headline improvements included a better camera, fingerprint scanner, a heart rate monitor. In a world of modular phones, you might be able to pick any or all of these features and add them to the phone you already have. You'd even be able to pick among multiple cameras or choose quirky features not meant for the masses. The one I like best so far is an on-phone incense burner. Ara also speaks to an overarching
issue. Don't put that back in your pocket.
Yeah, right. Also speaks to or how about a cigarette lighter?
Yeah.
Ara also speaks to an overarching issue near to Google's heart, the need to get help, the need to help get another 5 billion people on the internet by bringing it to individuals and developing nations in affordable forms tailored to their needs. The first expression of the modular concept Ara's creators are focusing on is a smartphone with a target price of $50 that is so basic it comes only with Wi-Fi, not a cellular connection. But remember, it's modular, so you can add a module with whatever carrier's stuff in it you want. So if you're in the United States, you can put in a Verizon or an AT&T or a Sprint or whatever. If you're in Japan, you can put in Docomo or whoever you want.
If you're in
what?
Canada, you can stick in Bell or Rogers or TELUS or Fido or what?
Yeah. Right. And in fact, you can switch them. If you're an overseas traveler, pop out one, pop in another one, you're on your way. As its owner's needs evolve and budget permits, new modules would make it better and better and better. So would you buy a modular phone? Give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free 1-800-790-0415. Oh, and what module would you really want that you can't get in a phone today?
And I wonder if by the time you add all the modules in you want, it would be more expensive than just buying a pre-built phone that had them all in the first place.
But you don't spend all that money right at once. That's the big difference. If you could spend $50 this month, $20 next month, $30 the month after, eventually, yeah, you end up with a $600 phone. But you can also swap out parts. You know what? I could afford 2 gig a year ago. Now I'm going to swap that out for 4 gig. Now I'm going to swap it out for 16 gig, whatever that happens to be.
Yeah, you can selectively spend your money.
You selectively spend your money and upgrade, and it becomes, you know, Abraham Lincoln's grandfather's axe. It's had 3 different heads and 4 different handles, but it's the same axe. All right, listen, we're going to take another quick break, but we'll be back in just a couple of minutes with Steve Ray, Michael Oden, me, Nick Francesco, and you. It is 40 minutes after the hour, and you're continuing to listen to the longest-running computer show in the known universe. We are Soundbites. You can give us a call. It's member-supported. Jazz 90.1. Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Steve Ray.
And I'm Michael Oden.
And in 44 minutes after the hour, we are Soundbites. I'm telling you, I would love to have a modular phone. I would love to be able to add features as they come out and to change features around. Maybe I want, you know, a 5-inch screen. Somebody else wants a 4-inch screen, whatever it happens to be.
That was the early context with desktop computers.
Right.
You bought this giant chassis and you put stuff in it that you wanted to have in it. Maybe you wanted 4 hard drives and 2 optical drives or this and that and the other thing. Replace better video cards. But, you know, over the last 30 years, we've sort of seen that modularity kind of die down, and people are buying prepackaged computers. Right. And when something breaks, you throw it away and buy a new one.
Right. And you're right. We go to laptops, we buy iPads and Nexus devices, rather than modularizing it and buying what we want, we buy what someone else has put out on the shelves.
Right. And so the module is now a bigger piece. So you want a powerful computer, you buy this. You want a mobile computer, you buy that. So the modules don't interact physically anymore. They sync through the internet now.
Right. Right. And I don't know that this thing is going to be for everybody. But I love the idea. I think it's great.
Yeah.
You know, and in particular for kids, you buy your kid a basic phone, and as he or she gets older, maybe you add something, you add something, you add something, yeah. so that you're not spending a great deal of money to begin with. But, you know, it's your birthday. How would you like more, you know, a camera now?
We have a lot of parents who come into our store. They want to get their child an iPod Touch or even a cheap iPhone, but they're scared of the camera. And so by getting a model that doesn't have a camera in it, then you don't have to worry about that. And then when they're old enough and are more responsible enough, you put the camera module in.
Yeah, I can see this being big for things like that. I really can.
Yep.
It's a great idea, and I want one. You know, you can give us a call. 585-966-JAZZ. It's 966-5299. Toll free 1-800-790-0415. Must be nice out today.
And since all the smartphones now have the find tracking feature built in, so you can find it when it's lost, parents are also using that to track where their kids are.
Yes.
You said you were going to Billy's house, and you weren't at Billy's house. Your phone wasn't at Billy's house.
Yeah, right.
Well, it is above 20 degrees outside, so you know.
Yeah.
But sunny.
That's warm for the past few weeks.
Yeah.
I keep waiting.
It's 32 outside.
That's what I said. It's above 20.
Oh, above 20. It's nice out.
I've got a different coat for when it gets above freezing.
My cousin never wore a coat before something and after Easter. Easter Sunday was the last day he wore a coat. In Rochester, that's not bright.
Yeah.
Tommy.
We've had snow in July.
We're Rochester, New York. We may be the hub of civilization in the Western world, but we're also freezing to death. But it's 32 today.
Yeah.
It's above freezing. That's a beautiful thing. It's at freezing. Okay.
And the wind chill is 25 instead of negative 25.
Exactly. Any day that the wind chill's in positive numbers is a good day in Rochester, New York. That's how you know.
Yep.
That's exactly right.
I was talking to someone the other day about that, and they're from Canada, and which uses Celsius, and the two temperature scales merge at negative 40.
Right.
And so the closer you get to negative 40, the more the temperatures are the same. So, right. it's a you know, brisk day today. It's you know, negative 10. Okay, that's about 20 degrees. Our temperature in Fahrenheit.
Yeah, we had students who worked for us from the upper reaches of Canada, who came to RIT, and some of them worked for me. We had one guy who, in the dead of winter, would put on a sweater. So it's starting to get cold enough for him.
My favorite woolly jumper.
Right.
That's Hugh Bonneville on Top Gear a couple of weeks ago. They're making jokes about Lord Grantham was driving the car, and he had this really ugly sweater on, and he called it his favorite woolly jumper. And then he was on Graham Norton a week or two later, and they were joking with him about his favorite woolly jumper.
Yeah. Said,
well, it was, because they told me to dress warm because it's cold in the studio.
Right. Right. So I think I would love to have a modular phone. It would be so cool because you can get just the pieces you want. And again, you can upgrade. Oh, well, I can't. They've now come out with a 60 megapixel camera, and I really, really need that. So I'll go get it. All right. Our next caller is George from Greece, New York. Welcome, George. What's up?
Good afternoon, fellas. I have two questions.
Yeah.
One. I'm experiencing some wear off of the lettering on my keys for certain keys that get used most frequently on my computer. Is there a repair kit or some way that one can restore the white engraving?
Well,
oh, it's
yes
the other way.
No.
I was going to say a Sharpie.
Yeah.
If it's
yeah.
black letters on white keys, a Sharpie works really good.
Right. The problem is several fold. One is there, if you notice, most keyboards have a texture to them that makes it hard to put any sort of decal down on them. But you can buy replacement keys for many types of, this is a laptop?
Yes.
Yeah, for many laptops from the manufacturer. Generally, you buy them in a quantity because they're not designed for consumers.
right? They're designed to be sold to repair places, which will buy a bulk set of them.
Well, and there's two ways to do it. You can replace the actual key, or there are companies that sell just little stickers.
Right, yeah. But that's what I said first, is many of them now have a kind of the surface doesn't lend itself to stickers.
And a lot of the keyboards are backlit, so the keys glow at you. So on my computer, the keys aren't white, they're clear and transparent, so when the backlight is on, I can see the key glowing at me.
Right. Although, one of the things that you can do is, of course, become a touch typist.
if you got your fingers on the right keys to start with.
Yep.
The home set. That's why there's a little raised thing on the F and the J. That's where your index fingers go.
So I like Steve's approach there. Isn't there something equivalent to the white Sharpie? Just some little narrow thing that can reach in there and add a little whitening to the...
Sure. Well, you can, if you've got a steady hand, you can use whiteout.
Yep.
Are you serious?
Finally, a use for whiteout. I don't honestly know that will work because I think it'll flake out. But there are various paints that are durable, sustainable.
Yeah.
And you'd be able to do that. There are also companies, you do a search for replacement keyboard keys.
Yeah.
Okay.
And you will find there are companies that make stickers.
You go like to the craft store. I'm sure you can find an alphabetic sticker thing for a buck or two.
Right, right, right. Again, will it be satisfactory in another year when the edges start peeling up, et cetera, et cetera?
Yep.
That's a separate issue.
Spend another buck or two then.
Well, but now you gotta get the other one off and everything else.
Yeah.
But,
a lot of the same companies have big letters where you can make the key labels much bigger for people with poor eyesight.
So let me go to something that's the heart of information technology. I was trying to access a database that's available at a level of public government. So it's not a matter of trying to get into something I'm not entitled to.
Right.
They offer this. And I was encountering a message which said, there's a little circle with an eye in the center, and it's a message pertaining to Adobe Reader. And it says, the file is damaged and could not be repaired. Now, that suggested to me the problem was not on my end, but was, in fact, at the other end where the databases.
That's exactly right.
Were you using the actual Adobe Reader, or were you using a third-party reader?
I'm quite sure I was using Adobe Reader. I have that.
And that's one of the things with Adobe. Yeah, that's one of the interesting things we see a lot of times. Websites will say you need the Adobe Reader, and we'll give you a link to Adobe's website. That's because Adobe paid them.
Right.
You don't need the Adobe Reader. You need any PDF reader.
Well, but in this particular instance, the error message indicates that the file itself is damaged, which is nothing you could do. It could be that it was a bad download.
Or it could also be
of my file, but...
Yes. The file you downloaded and then tried to open glitched somewhere during the download and caused it to be damaged. So if you downloaded it again and there was no glitch, it would open.
Okay, I've also got a better lead here. Let's pursue that for a moment.
So you might try that, but it may well be that the file itself is in fact actually damaged.
When they uploaded it at the other end, it was damaged. I've also seen problems where it's a version disparity. So if you've got Adobe Reader 9 and the document was created for Reader 12, it may not open and give you a weird error like this.
So, Steve, I was pursuing that approach the other day when I was talking to someone on the other end. And so they patiently walked through. They were able to access the file. Now, this is at the location which makes the file available as far as the government is concerned. I don't know where the file might be located. I had tried several times and was getting the same message and tried several times after that person successfully accessed the file. The next day, I did the same thing, no change of software on my end, and I was successful in getting the file.
Well, that tells me that the issue was in transmission.
In transmission, and at that point, beyond anybody's knowledge or control, it's one of those things that comes and goes, perhaps.
Right, because how many connections are you making through the Internet itself, right? So it could be that one of those had a problem, and that now that problem, maybe you went through a different path, and so you avoided that problem, or the problem got fixed.
Oh, that's a good point.
It may be that at the time that you were downloading it, one of the servers was overloaded because of traffic, and that doing it again later, it wasn't overloaded. So there's a million things that will cause, particularly if it's a large file, it only has to be one glitch somewhere in a 10-minute download, right? So
it's not a 10-minute, but it is.
Well, but you understand my point.
I understand your point.
Right.
And so the path of the person that was trying to help me, they were experiencing a different path, not by design, just because of the way they accessed it.
Right, exactly right. Mm.
Okay. I appreciate that very much.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
And the old adage that we fall back on is sometimes things that break themselves will often fix themselves.
That's exactly right.
If it doesn't work, wait 10 minutes, try again. It might work then.
Right. We find that a lot. No one has control of the internet. And so, consequently, there's a great deal of variability.
We have Don from Hilton on the line, who has a response to the computer keyboard question.
Oh, perfect. Go ahead, Don.
Well, I've done things similar to that by taking an engraver. You can engrave the letter into it.
Even a Dremel
just
tool.
Paint on it. And then wipe the paint off, and the paint will stay inside that engraving.
Right. Nice. And then you just have to let it dry before you start typing.
Yeah, because that will work. And since it's down inside, it doesn't wear off as quickly.
That's a good thought. Yep. That's an excellent thought. Thanks, Don.
Okay, bye.
Bye. Did you say Don was from Penfield? Hilton. Okay.
That's disparate.
That was so close.
Yeah. That's a neat idea. And if you don't have an engraving tool, even a Dremel tool, you could probably do something. I would recommend unplugging the computer and removing the battery.
Yes,
before you do any of that.
Yeah, definitely.
Because particularly if you're grinding away at something, static will build up.
And pouring liquid into your key.
Yeah, is contraindicated. You want to be very careful doing that.
We've had a bunch of spills at our shop lately, and one woman said, she spilled a glass of tea in her computer and didn't think anything of it because the computer kept working for a couple of days.
Right.
And now the logic board is toast and it's an expensive repair.
It's going to be a very expensive repair.
Well, and that's I understand the impulse. Oh my God, I just spilled water on my whatever. I want to turn it on, make sure it works. Turning it on will break it.
Right.
Electricity and fluids do not mix.
Right. So and you leave it off until it dries. Turn it upside down.
Take the battery out if you can. A lot of laptops and smartphones these days, you can't take the batteries out anymore.
No, only Apple.
I have some of the Samsung ones you can't.
Yeah, it's true.
and so it's hard to get the battery out, so there's always power running through it.
Right.
Turn it upside down. We hear a lot of reports about the putting it in rice trick because the rice will absorb the fluid.
Ish.
One of the best things we read about was a hearing aid cleaner because the hearing aids are electronic and you have to wash them. And so if you happen to have one, it's a non-conductive fluid that will wash out your device. And then it's like a little humidor that you dry it out in.
Assuming that your device will actually fit in that humidor.
Yeah, so you got to get a big enough one.
Right.
Really big hearing aids.
Really big hearing aids. There's a business servicing people with those, buying a big one and then go to their house and clean it. All right, listen, that's it for this hour. We're the first hour is just gone now. I don't know where it went. You don't know where it went, but it's gone. But luckily, we have a whole nother hour of this nonsense to go through. So stay tuned. We're going to take a slightly longer break this time because I personally need a nap. And then we're going to come back with a whole lot more of Steve Ray, Michael Oden, me, Nick Francesco, and you. It is 59 minutes after the hour, and you are listening to the longest-running computer show in the known universe. We are Soundbites, happily ensconced on member-supported Jazz 90.1. See you in a bit.
to America's longest-running computer show, Soundbites, on member-supported Jazz 90.1. Get online now. Call 966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll-free 800-790-0415. Or submit your question by email at soundbites.org. Once again, here's Nick Francesco, Dave Enright, and Steve Ray on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Steve Ray.
And I'm Michael Oden.
And in 4 minutes after the hour, we're hurtling headlong into the second hour of the longest-running computer show in the known universe. Yep, it's Soundbites on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Is it okay if I hurtle feet long?
You can hurtle feet long, head long, arm long, week long, Lazarus long. I don't really care. This is yet another one of those stories. Mount Gox. GOX, the troubled exchange for the virtual currency Bitcoin, filed for bankruptcy protection on Friday and said that it might have lost 750,000 of its customers' coins, essentially all of them, in a hacking attack. The Tokyo-based exchange, which warned this month of a software flaw that may have allowed hackers to defraud it of Bitcoins, has halted all trading this week. Mark Carpelli's, the company's chief executive, wearing a suit instead of his usual T-shirt, bowed in contrition and apologized in Japanese at a press conference in Tokyo. There were weaknesses in the system, he said. I'm truly sorry to have caused inconvenience. He said that the exchange has most likely lost 750,000 of its customers' Bitcoin holdings and more than 100,000 of its own coins, or more than 450 million dollars worth of Bitcoins. Mount Gox has said it on its website on Wednesday that it was still working very hard toward resolution. Clearly, that didn't work. Investors in the exchange had said that they did not expect to recover their money stashed on the Mount Gox platform, which once accounted for 4/5 of the world's Bitcoin trading. But Mt. Gox's bankruptcy, filed with the Tokyo District Court under Japan's civil rehabilitation law, which is similar to Chapter 11 in the United States, will mean that a bankruptcy supervisor is set to develop a restructuring plan and will also be responsible for handling any payment of claim distributions to its creditors. That process could take from several months to several years. The exchange has liabilities of 6.5 billion yen, or $64 million, compared to total assets of 3.8 billion yen, it has 127,000 creditors. The demise of Mt. Gox did not come as a surprise for many, and as fans' skepticism in some quarters over the virtual currency's future in Japan and, well, everywhere. I didn't think something like this would last long. I thought it would collapse at some point, Taro Arzo, the Japanese finance minister, told reporters early Friday. He also suggested that Japan might move to regulate Bitcoin. Not everybody accepts it as a legitimate currency, and it's unclear who would supervise it. Japan must do something about it. So, do you have Bitcoins, Litecoins, Dogecoins, or any of those? Give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free 1-800-790-0415. Not terribly surprising, given that Mt. Gox is MTGOX, which stands for Magic the Gathering Online Exchange. Yes, Mt. Gox, where people stored millions and billions of dollars worth of bitcoins, used to be the place that kids went to exchange Magic the Gathering cards.
They diversified.
Okay, you know your business model may be flawed when...
Yeah. Bitcoins, for those of you who don't know, are I want to say non-existent currency. Basically...
Non-government currency.
Non-backed currency.
Non-physical currency.
Non-physical currency, certainly. What happens is you join a Bitcoin community... And, yeah, they call it a cryptocurrency. They call it any one of a dozen different things. You join a community and you use processing power on your computer to do certain things. And however much processing power you used gives you that much Bitcoin. Right now, it's years' worth of processing power. Actually, decades' worth of standard processing power in order to get like a tenth of a Bitcoin. Most of it's being done by graphics processing units, which are much faster and much more powerful than GPUs are much more powerful and faster than CPUs. They will sell you devices for thousands of dollars that will generate a Bitcoin in several months. And there are a lot of them. Like I said, there's Bitcoin, there's Litecoin, there's Dogecoin, there's or Dogcoin or Dogecoin or however you pronounce it, and a dozen others that are all out there, all attempting to create a currency that is not tied to anything except computing power.
Yeah, they call it a consensus network. So everyone agrees what a Bitcoin is worth, which is sort of what actual government money has become. You know, when we used to be on the gold standard or the silver standard. So we have a piece of paper that we agree is worth this much.
Right.
And it says on it, backed in faith by the government.
Right. Well, yeah. But that's the idea. There's a government that backs it. Here it's a couple of kids in T-shirts and a website that used to trade.
Well, and that
Magic
I think that
cards.
Was a lot of the problem is the Bitcoins existed before all these exchanges popped up to convert them into real money, physical money. And as soon as the speculators got involved trying to make money off of it, the exchanges started dying.
Right.
And the bit concept and trading of Bitcoins themselves is nothing inherently wrong with that.
Right, right. But what's interesting is that, of course, you know, nobody knows anything yet. Speculation is these guys just stole all those Bitcoins, all that money. I don't know where they're going to get actual cash for those Bitcoins.
Since they were the primary exchange.
Right. Since they were the exchange. But so I don't put a lot of credence on those. But people, you know, have been using them to buy all kinds of things. There was a reporter who went to a conference and spent the entire week on nothing but Bitcoin. She paid for her hotel room, her food, everything with Bitcoins. And there are people who use Bitcoins still online for various thises and thats.
There's 12 million Bitcoins in circulation. So they're, 750,000?
Right.
Is less than a tenth of a percent. Which is a lot, but less than a tenth of a percent.
Right, right. Well, it's the most well-known.
Yeah.
And I believe the largest individual exchange.
Yeah.
It's really kind of shaken the community, the Bitcoin community. A lot of people, it's shaken their faith in Bitcoins. And again, it's not just Bitcoins. Bitcoins are what were stolen, but there are Litecoins and Dogecoins and everything else, so...
You would figure that when a company that was trading cards for kids got into the Bitcoin market, you would figure that may have possibly shaken their confidence a little bit in the faith of the Bitcoin.
Well, instead of trading cards, they're trading currency values.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
And it's not just kids. There are a lot of adults who play Magic the Gathering, and I'm not disparaging it, except in the context of you've made it your world bank.
But when you have a site that does that, and it's switched over to Bitcoin, you would figure that you would lose some faith in it then, not
right
now when, oh my God, everything's been suddenly stolen.
Right. And it's not Bitcoin. A regulated banking endeavor, so there's no insurance. So these, you know, if you put your money in a real bank and it goes bankrupt, there's insurance that you get and that you have the FDIC and stuff like that
to
give you some money.
It's only $100,000 per account,
right.
So when you get more than that, make more accounts.
Well, that's exactly right.
Yeah.
And people do that.
Yeah. But Bitcoin had a big problem last year, too.
Yep.
When the FBI shut down a black market internet society called Silk Road, most of the bad guys were using Bitcoins to pay for stolen property on Silk Road.
Right.
So it's sort of Bitcoin sort of got a reputation as being, you know, the bad guy's currency, which wasn't actually true, but it got that reputation along the way.
Right. Anyway, our next caller is Harry from Rochester, New York. Welcome, Harry. What's up?
Oh, hi, guys. I cannot restart my XP, 10-year-old XP machine. And I've got the black screen with some instructions to select one of five ways to possibly get it started. None of them work. And Do you have any recommendations or questions?
And of course, you have a lot of data on there that you've never backed up.
No, I backed it up.
Oh, yay!
But it's 6 months ago.
Oh,
so I,
yay.
So, yeah. I think there's some, it can't reboot. I guess that's one way. And 10 years ago, I'm sure I made the reboot disk, but...
Yeah, it depends on whether it's a hardware problem or a software problem. If it's a software problem in Windows, you might be able to reinstall Windows over Windows if you can still find your XP disk.
Right.
If it's a hardware problem, it may be a failure in the hard drive or the RAM, or because it's such an old computer, any of those hardware pieces could be failing as well.
What you might do is call a reputable vendor,
right.
Have them take the hard drive out.
Uh-huh.
And put it in a separate machine as the secondary drive. And if it is readable, they will at least be able to get your data off it.
Okay.
But honestly, it's a lot cheaper to buy a new machine than to try to fix a 10-year-old machine.
Yeah, I've got the new machine sitting here also.
Well, if you're comfortable and know how to do it, you can pull the hard drive out of the old one, put it in the new one to get your data.
No, I can't see what I'm doing, so I need an expert.
Yeah,
yeah. Your best bet is to call your favorite dealer.
Yeah, I think the guy's name last name starts with E.
Well, that's a possibility.
Yeah. Okay, Enright. That's right.
There you go.
Okay. Thank you.
Yep. Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
A lot of times you can get help like that through the users group, too. A lot of the user groups will have hands-on nights. We at Apple Cider, we meet the second Wednesday of the month at East High School, and then we have a hands-on Q&A presentation on the Saturday following that. The Rochester Computer Society is the second Tuesday of the month, and then the Linux users group of Rochester is the third Thursday of the month.
So, and Rochester Googles is this coming Thursday, the first Thursday of the month. We meet at St. John's Meadow.
Yep.
And one of the things we'll be talking about this week a little bit is Google Script. But we're also going to entertain people's questions about Chromebooks and about Google and about pretty much the whole world of Google stuff, Android, everything. So... feel free to come down and join us. We have a Google group and a Facebook page, so you can find us there and find more information about it. And we'd love to see you there.
So yes, it's like Soundbites during the week.
It's exactly right.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah,
we will answer people's questions. We prefer to keep it to Google for that particular group. But yes, we will answer people's computer questions. And if you've never seen a Chromebook, I usually have mine. Emily has hers, so come on down and check them out.
Where'd you say you meet?
We meet at St. John's Meadow.
Same place Rochester Computer Society is meeting.
Yes, it is. They're in a different room.
That's
the better room.
It's a big thing with a lot of these nonprofit groups and groups in general. You're trying to find a cheap place to meet around town.
Yeah. Yeah.
What's the cheapest place you got? No, I need cheaper than that.
Yep. Yeah, right.
What's the cheapest place you have?
The great Art Trimble has arranged for those rooms for both groups. He's a magnificent human being and a terrific guy. And so we'll be meeting there, like I said, Thursday. I think it's 7 is the start of the meeting. Might be earlier. I don't know. I just go whenever Emily tells me to go. So, but we'll we'll see you all there. Cherry knows. He'll tell me. No, I guess he doesn't. But that's we're planning that. It's going to be. It's a fun meeting every week. Good people. Interesting information. And Google is kind of at the heart of much of what goes on the internet these days when it comes to searching and email and documents and everything else. If you're doing those things online, you certainly, according to the statistics I see, many, 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 many people are doing those in Google things. So, yeah, some pretty interesting stuff, I'll tell you that. So we meet this Thursday. And if you're listening to us on the podcast, I hope you listened before Thursday. So we meet the first Thursday of every month. March 6th will be meeting this year. What? No, yes, that would be right.
That's the first
Thursday
of the month,
yeah.
Yes. Coming up on St. Patrick's Day for your four-leaf clover.
Right, we have four-leaf clovers. Emily puts that up every year. Every month she puts up an interesting different thing, and we...
She's stealing the Google Doodle concept?
That's exactly right. And why not? We're Google.
Yep.
It's an homage. This is, you put them right in the thing, too.
Yep.
Listen, we're going to take a quick break. Excuse me while I choke to death right here in front of you. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes with Steve Ray, Michael Oden, me, Nick Francesco, and you. It is 19 minutes after the hour, and you're listening to the longest-running computer show in the known universe. It's Soundbites on member-supported Jazz 90.1. Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Michael Oden.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And at 23 minutes after the hour, we are Soundbites, and we have Joel from Pittsford, New York on the line. Welcome, Joel. What's up?
Yeah, hi, guys. I wanted to get your thoughts on the Netflix Comcast deal and its implications for net neutrality.
Yeah, that sent a shiver down my spine.
Yeah, Comcast and Netflix were in a standoff. The basics are that Comcast was allegedly, I'm on the air, so I have to say allegedly, slowing down Netflix, and that they wanted Netflix to pay them to not slow them down. In the real world, we call that extortion. On the internet, apparently, we call that doing business. I'm Italian, I understand doing business, but still, it's extortion, and allegedly, my personal opinion only. I don't speak for this station, for anybody here at this station, or any right-thinking human being, really. Netflix blinked, they paid.
And this has been going on for a while now, that studies have come out and showing that Netflix is like 30-40% of all internet traffic during primetime hours. And generally speaking, internet providers don't charge each other to carry each other's feeds. So Comcast and Cox and Time Warner, they just let each other's feed go through. And Netflix pays somebody to get on the internet. And I think it was level 3. So Netflix is saying, well, we're already paying for internet access from our provider. Why should we have to pay every provider? And for the most of us, they have a point. They shouldn't have to pay other providers than their own. But Comcast was one of the biggest ones, saying because there's so much of Comcast traffic is coming from Netflix, we want Netflix to pay us.
Right. And, of course, the problem with that is extortion never ends. It just gets more.
So now what is Cox and Time Warner going to go to Netflix and say, you got to pay us too? And what it may end up happening is that Netflix is going to have to raise their prices to pay for these payments. And it could stifle other competition because other services that may come up to do video streaming or other types of internet services now may not, because they're afraid they're going to have to pay Comcast and other providers. So
right.
It's
small folks like Soundbites.
Yeah.
Right. Well, right. Now, does this station then, will there come a point where this station has to pay to stream 24/7? It's got to be an awfully small part of anybody's data stream, but it's a part. And at what point do we decide that the whole internet is no longer an open internet, that now net neutrality is completely gone, and if I want to connect to you, I have to pay at least two or three middle people?
And that's also the big concern about the Comcast-Time Warner merger, that if Fox wants to stream video, they have to pay Time Warner extra money to get through Time Warner Internet. And no one wants that, because it just raises prices for the end users anytime anything like this happens.
This is a very bad thing, and you would think that someone who had the interest of the public at heart, like, say, our legislatures... would actually in some way step in. But no one did, of course. And so this bodes ill, I think, for pretty much all of us and everything we do on the internet.
There's a good video on Funny or Die. It was posted either yesterday or today. And I can't mention a word on the air.
Yeah.
But it's basically about Comcast buying Time Warner Cable. And in part of it, they mention, well, you have to Netflix is paying us, and you know where they're going to pass that cost along to. And we own Hulu. So, yeah, we own everybody.
Yep. Yep. And
good news, guys. Well, thank you for your thoughts.
Yep. Thank you. Thanks. And the reality is that we're at a point now where the whole concept of net neutrality is in jeopardy, I don't know why our lawmakers don't step in. I'm sure
Al Franken is stepping in the Comcast Time Warner thing. He seems to be the only one that actually cares or knows and does anything about this stuff.
I know. Al Franken, for God's sake.
It's like an actor becoming president, you know?
Yeah, who would think that could ever happen? But I'll tell you what, now, as much as I never found him rib-ticklingly funny on the air, I got a certain amount of respect for him now.
Yeah.
All right, back to the phones. Our next caller is Tom from Greece, New York. Welcome, Tom. What's up?
Hi. I got a little thing going on here with, you know, the icons on the screen.
Yeah.
I can, you know, uninstall them if I want.
Sure.
And all of these ones are all off to the left, and I could do that. I did have my taxes done last year with the Turbo tax thing.
Right.
And that's on my computer on the right side icon. I don't want that information in my computer anymore. I don't need that. I'm trying to get rid of that, period. And I can't even find out where, because you could pull up that information on your
right. Okay, a couple of things, Tom. First, Tom, a couple of things here. First, is this a Windows machine? And if so, what version?
Windows 7.
Okay. Removing an icon from the screen does not remove the program from your computer.
And annoyingly, oftentimes uninstalling the program does not remove the icon from the screen.
Right.
So you got three things going on. You got to remove the icon from the desktop. You have to uninstall the program using the Add Remove Programs control panel. And the third thing is your actual data file. So the very first time you opened your TurboTax, and this goes with any program, you saved your data file probably in your documents folder. And data files generally don't take up that much room, so most people just ignore that. But especially for something like TurboTax that gets updated every year, you don't need last year's program anymore. So that you can uninstall from the control panel, and you can delete the icon from the desktop.
Right.
But you may have to do that as two steps.
I can't find it in the control panel to uninstall it, is what my turn says.
You may already have uninstalled it, and it just left the icon behind. Or especially something like TurboTax.
You already have?
You may have already uninstalled it. But when you open the icon on the desktop, does the program open?
Yeah.
Okay, so it is still in there. One of the tricks with TurboTax is it's made by a company called Intuit. So it may not be listed under T for TurboTax. It may be under I for Intuit.
Here's the thing I would try first. Under the Start menu, you have a selection called Programs.
Yes.
If you open that, you may see TurboTax, but you may also just see Intuit. I-N-T-U-I-T.
Right.
If you open that, you may find an uninstall program there.
So some programs have their own uninstaller outside of the control panel.
Right.
And if all that fails, then Revo uninstaller.
Well, right. But I would try that first. If that
I've
does
got the Revo on installer,
and does Revo when you run Revo, does it find TurboTax? Again, it may be called into it. It may not be called TurboTax.
Right. I guess I'm not. As far as running the uninstaller, okay, I'm in this thing right now. I'm trying to.
Soundboys, your name is.
Yeah, I guess I don't know what you mean. Okay, just push Revo uninstaller, and then it'll come up with.
Revo uninstaller will come up with a list of all the programs that are installed if you. If you click on TurboTax or again on Intuit, you should have the option of uninstalling that program.
Right. Okay. Because I can't. I'm in the control panel.
Right.
And I cannot find that Intuit or.
Right. So
the TurboTax.
Right. So instead of
in
being,
here.
Right. So instead of being in the control. Instead of being in the control panel, close that out and start Revo uninstaller instead. And try
okay.
that.
All right, I'll try that then.
Perfect.
Yeah. Yeah, that sounds good. Thank you.
Perfect. Thank you so much.
Some programs okay, don't want you to uninstall them, which is a little annoying. Why would you uninstall my program?
Right, well, right, right.
Because I don't need last year's program anymore. I'm getting this year's taxes. So I did find a link on how to forcefully uninstall TurboTax. So apparently... uninstalling is a problem because they have instructions on how to force it to uninstall.
So Steve will post that on the Soundbites website. You'll see it as one of the main stories right there at the front in large letters. In just a couple of minutes, do a refresh, and you'll see it there.
And if you start with the normal way of uninstalling and that doesn't work, then they have these force uninstall instructions.
Right, but try the normal way first. Try normal. If that clearly didn't work for you, try Revo. If that doesn't work, then you can try this. All right, back to the phones. Our next caller is Marie from Chi-Line, New York. Welcome, Marie. What's up?
Hi. I have several questions, if you have time for...
well, go. Let's see how many
for.
We can get.
One question is kind of a general... I don't know if you've ever heard of any sources that are reputable for charity purposes, like for raising funds for a cause or for some people. And I'm familiar with, there's one called youcaring.com. It's a free online fundraising. So I wanted to try using something like that, but I'm a little nervous about, scams and things
sure.
like that. And
sure, sure.
They use PayPal for people to donate the money. I don't know if you've heard of anything or if any other listeners may have heard of anything.
Kickstarter and Indiegogo
yeah.
are probably the two biggest national ones.
Which, I'm sorry, I didn't hear.
Kickstarter.
What is it?
KickStarter.
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 Okay. Okay.
And the other one is called Indiegogo, IndieGogo.
I ran across that one. Uh-huh. Okay. So you feel that those are reputable?
Those are indeed reputable. They have been around for a while, and they are well-known and definitely reputable.
Oh, very good. Okay, I'm glad I asked you. Thank you. So another question is... I have a printer that's maybe 5-6 years old, but I rarely use it, and it won't print now. And I'm wondering if, do you think that it has to do with maybe like all dried up ink in the cartridges
yep.
or something
yeah.
like that?
Yeah, especially liquid ink printers. The liquid ink can dry up. Normally, every time you turn the printer on, it will do an ink head cleaning where it tries to scrape off that dried up ink from being turned off yesterday. Mm-hmm. If you don't use it for a while, that can dry up too much and it can't be scraped off. And then in essence, the printer is useless. Some printers have the ink and the head as a single cartridge. HP has a lot of those.
Yes, but I got HP.
So if you can replace the print head and replace the print cartridge, you can get it working again. And an often better step is a laser printer rather than an ink printer,
mm-hmm.
Because the laser doesn't dry out like that. Laser printers cost a little more to begin with, but they cost less in the long run to own because the consumable cost is so much cheaper. Laser toner is a lot cheaper per print than liquid ink. And even color laser printers now are under $300, and then you get the best of both worlds. Yep. But you can get a black and white laser printer for like $150, which isn't that much more than a than an inkjet printer.
Okay. All right. I'm going to try to play with this one I got a little bit more. So you said
sometimes alcohol and a Q-tip can help clean the head off.
Yeah, and actually I did, and it didn't help things any. And there was a message that popped up that said that it was something having to do with the cartridge, but I can't get that message anymore, so I can't tell you what it said. I've forgotten what
it could also be if it is 5 or 6 years old, the ink could have expired. Some companies have an expiration date on their ink.
I've changed the ink cartridges a few times already since I've had it.
So it probably is the head then, and replacing the head on the printer is much more expensive than a new printer.
Than a new printer, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So that's that question. The other thing that I am confused about when I get all these things telling me to download this and download that. So like, for example, download manager, free download, install a free download manager. I have Windows 7. So I just need to know whether to do this or not.
Now, that's a completely unnecessary thing.
There's a download manager built into Windows and Mac.
Right. If they just want to install something so they can show you ads, don't bother.
Okay. Yeah, that's what I worry about. So, yeah.
Yep.
Okay. Another one is Java Auto Updater by Oracle.
Yes, do that.
Yes.
Yes, make sure you have Java updated. But most people don't need to have Java running at all. Oh. So if you go into your Add Remove control panel and uninstall Java, are you using something like OpenOffice or a LibreOffice?
No, I have Microsoft Word and Office, and I use.
If you're using Microsoft Office, you don't need to have Java installed at all. So you can go into your add remove programs and uninstall it and see if something complains. Because like Flash, Java is an attack vector for the bad guys. So you have to install all these updates all the time to keep those holes patched. But if you don't need to have Java, just uninstall it completely.
Okay.
And most people don't need Java.
Oh, okay.
All right. Marie, we have to take a break. Thank you, Marie.
Thank you very much.
We're going to take a break. Back in just a couple of minutes with Steve Ray, Michael Oden, me, Nick Francesco, and you. 40 minutes after the hour, Soundbites, member-supported Jazz 90.1. Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Steve Ray.
And I'm Michael Oden.
And at 44 minutes after the hour, we have Ernesto from Farmington, New York, on the line. Welcome, Ernesto. What's up?
Parenting, actually.
Oh, sorry.
No problem. Listen, guys, I've been having a lot of trouble with my Wi-Fi at my job. I just bought a new HP Envy laptop, and the Wi-Fi keeps going out because I use an electronic medical record, and which is on a server, and I have a client thing on my machine. It keeps losing the connection. I've had Microsoft technician take a look at it. They couldn't figure it out. I called HP. I don't know how many times already, and they're finally they've given up with me, and they're going to send me another Wi-Fi card. I've done everything in terms of system file checker. I did a DISM clear image, restore health utility. I've done everything, and the thing still, it works for a little while, and then it pops out. Then I have to reset it with the troubleshooting on the Windows provides, and it resets the adapter, and I'm back in business. I go for a little while, and then it keeps popping up the Wi-Fi again. So I've talked to my IT people at the job. They can't figure it out. HP is going to do is send me a new Wi-Fi card. I don't know what else to do here.
I think that's the solution. I can see thousands of people who are having problems with Envy wireless, and the solution generally the ones I've sampled while you were talking were HP sent me a new card.
You think that'll settle the issue?
Well, it's the next step, certainly. You know, if you've done all the other things and none of those solve the issue, then the next step is hardware. And so them replacing the card itself is really the next viable step.
Okay.
If that doesn't work, I'm not even sure where to go at this point, but definitely, you know, if HP themselves recommended doing this and they're sending you that new card, I think that's the way to go.
Or if you have a friend that has another card, you can try.
No.
A lot of times you can get an external USB Wi-Fi adapter.
Right.
Relatively inexpensively.
Mm-hmm.
Right, that'll be the next step after this. I mean, as long as they're sending him one, why don't you try it?
And if it's a brand new computer, if replacing the card doesn't work, I would shoot for a new computer.
Yeah, if it's still under warranty, you know.
It just voted January.
Yeah, there are lemon laws. If you've never been able to get that to successfully work and you can document that, then I think you're on your way to a new computer.
All right. Thanks a lot, guys.
Good luck.
Thanks. Bye.
Yeah, that's a general issue that we see a lot is, you know, stuff doesn't – there are problems with hardware. We see it all the time with hard drives. The average lifespan of a hard drive is 5 years. That means some last 10, some are dead out of the box. So it could very easily be the same issue here. All right, back to the phones. Our next caller is Marshall from Caledonia, New York.
Hi, Steve, Nick, Michael.
How are you?
I am fine. I am a Quicken 2011 user. I've used Quicken back to the old DOS days, I think. They're, of course, informing me now that at the end of April, certain functions are no longer going to work. Mostly you can't download your transactions from the Internet,
right,
which I never do. I always enter all my own data, but I love all of the other functions of Quicken.
Right.
Is there any way around this? Do you have suggestions of alternate software, or can I simply just continue to use 2011?
Well, you can continue to use
the features that keep working.
That keep working, right? I mean, that's kind of the way that's gonna happen. There are a number of alternatives to Quicken. There's a free program called Mint that's from Intuitive.
Mint,
M-I-N-T.
Mint tracks your transactions automatically, but I haven't found a way to add them manually yet. They do have a nice iPad app. So you give it all your bank account numbers and it watches your transactions for you.
Yeah, I don't want to do that. I want to be able to control everything right on my own hard drive.
Are you Mac or Windows?
Windows.
GNU Cache will do it.
I tried that.
Wasabi is a web-based thing.
You could always upgrade Quicken to the latest version.
Right.
Right.
Yeah, but I'm a little tired of their game.
Well, the light version of Ace Money is free. I've heard of one called Yodlee, Yodlee, but I have no experience with it. Mm-hmm. I've used GNU Cache, GNU Cache.
Mm-hmm.
It was originally designed for Linux, so I've been using it for, I don't know, decades. It's now available for OS X and Windows. And others, it's totally free.
There's a nice one for the Mac called iBank. I was looking to see if they have a Windows version, but it doesn't look like they do.
Right. It's very popular among Linux people. It's really designed for double entry accounting.
Uh-huh. Well, I'm inclined to lean towards something like that. It also sounds like there's no clear competitor out there that comes anywhere close to Quicken.
No, the other thing about GNU Cache is that it will import Quicken data.
Oh, it will.
Yeah.
Because Intuit
is the 800-pound gorilla, and a lot of the other companies have tried and given up. Microsoft Money was popular for a while, but they gave up.
Right.
There is a company called Mind Your Own Business that is probably one of the more serious commercial competitors to Intuit, and they have a personal version and a business version, MYOB. MindYourOwnBusiness.com, mm-hmm. I think is the URL. In the Mac world, we had a few years where Intuit left the Mac market. QuickBooks is their business version of accounting. And MYOB got a lot of traction then. And then when Intuit came back with QuickBooks for Mac, I was annoyed that so many were saying, oh, you can finally do accounting again on the Mac. Well, you could all along, just not from Intuit. It's the same the same thing we run into with Microsoft Office. There are a lot of Office suites, but you don't have to have the Microsoft Office suite.
Right.
There's also one called Home Bank. Again, I don't know all the features of all of these. I know GNU Cash seems to be the number one alternative, free alternative, because it's been around for years and it does everything.
Mm-hmm. The GNU?
GNU Cash.
Okay. Yeah, well, I don't need it to be free. I'm happy to pay people for developing good applications, but...
Well, but the nice thing about GNU Cash is that it is free to try, so...
Absolutely.
You know, give it a shot. If it works, then you win, and if it doesn't, then you still win because you didn't pay much for it.
And
there's also one that's Java-based, speaking of that, called MoneyDance.
And a lot of people just use a spreadsheet and do it themselves. Mm-hmm. If all you want is a calculator to make sure your checkbook is doing the math right, then a spreadsheet can do that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, a lot of good options here.
There you go. Yep. Good luck.
Okay, thanks a lot.
I just ran into a problem with my Quicken trying to get into my ESL account. ESL keeps asking me for my second factor authentication every time I log in, even though I said this is my private computer, don't ask me again.
Yeah, we see that a lot. That little piece is not working correctly. Yeah. That's
so now when Intuit, my Quicken is trying to download my transactions, it's asking for that second factor and there's no link there.
Right. We have the same problem with a system at RIT. It when you say remember me, it pops up this big thing that says, "Are you sure you should never use this on a public computer?" Blah blah blah. And you go, "This is a private computer," and it asks you again next time.
Yep.
And yes, my cookies are allowed and all that other yada yada. And believe me, I know. And it's still not happening. But yeah, I've been using GNU Cash for a while. I'm not a heavy duty user because I haven't got a lot of money to put in it, but I have been I have been using it. I'm assuming it will do, you know, numbers with two commas in them.
It is annoying. Most companies will discontinue support for their old software, but Intuit is stopping support for 2011. This is only 2014. That's only 3 years old. Most companies, 5, 6, 7 years.
Well, Intuit's a very money-hungry company.
Yeah.
So as long as they can make money off it, they're going to stop doing upgrades and say, okay, we're going to stop doing upgrades. Now you need to buy our latest software in order to get the upgrades.
Yeah.
Right.
It does look like it's just downloading transactions from your bank and online services. And, of course, tech support. But I've never had tech support work well for them anyway. I call us.
So far, GNU Cash has been fine for me. They upgrade it regularly. I haven't looked in a while, but they had a bunch of folks who were actually working on the product, a good group of people, and they've been keeping it up to date for a while. So
they still support PowerPC. That's 10 years old.
Yeah, but you know what? That's just a compiler setting.
Really?
Right? So
PowerPC versus Intel, its instruction sets are completely different.
Compiler set.
Yeah.
If you're writing this in, that's always been true.
Yeah.
If you write a program in, for example, C or C sharp or C plus or C Osaken, you go to compile it and you just tell it this is the architecture. You can target, it's a target compiler. This is the architecture I want to send it to. Not that hard to do. All right, listen, we're done for another week. That's Michael subtly telling me we're finished. I want to thank everybody who called in. I want to apologize to all those to whom we did not get. Call earlier next time. You may have noticed that the first hour was light on calls. The second hour was pretty well stuffed with them. So call in the first hour if you can next time around. We're going to... we're waving goodbye. Is that what that was about? Yeah. We'll be back next week with a whole lot more of the longest running computer show in the known universe. We may even have Dave Enright back. It's Soundbites. on member-supported Jazz 90.1. See you next week.